Yes, tonight's topic is getting our buttons pushed, especially by those we love or can't fucking avoid. So, these are the people that we have significant histories with, generally, and we react in, well, historical ways. I think we all know what it's like to have our buttons pushed. Generally, it's a reaction, which means it's very quick, and it's habitually driven, and we find ourselves with someone that we know well, and suddenly we're very impatient. We can become very defensive, even though, in retrospect, we weren't being attacked. It can feel physically like we're being attacked. Or there's just this feeling of being uncomfortable. There's a tendency to snap, attack disproportionately to what's being said. There's a tendency at times to mishear what's really being said and to hear something much more aggressive than was the intention. Let's see if there's any others. There's a tendency to be very evasive and to shut down, to suddenly find oneself just freezing, or not literally cold, but freezing in that fight, flight, or freeze type shutting down. Very often after we have our buttons pushed, we can binge on food or substances we're addicted to make the feelings of vulnerability go away. Very often when it's with people that we love, getting one's buttons pushed can lead to a feedback loop where we take something personally or they take something personally and there's an aggressive response, and then the person who hears the response feels under attack and they respond aggressively or defensively, and it accumulates. It becomes a confrontation, a spiraling interaction, where each is now pushing each other's buttons. As these coping strategies are habitually ingrained, they can be very, very addictive. Just like addictions, we don't think we have a choice during the moment. We can only think of one way to respond. And we don't realize it very often, but our coping strategies, especially with our family and friends and co-workers and roommates and what have you, bandmates. Bands are the worst if you've ever been in one. They can sabotage relationships and leave us very isolated and leave us feeling very confused. There's a lot of denial associated with coping strategies. We don't, until much later, we don't realize how unskillful we were behaving. But during the interaction, there's so much stress and discomfort that we say things that, and we feel okay with it, because when we're shouting or running away or defending ourselves beyond the call of duty or hammering away at a point beyond its usefulness, there is this feeling that we're not feeling the stress in the body. So it feels like it's accomplishing something. But then after we yell or run away or freeze or shut down or whatever our coping strategy is, we notice that the stress is still there. It hasn't left the body. And on top of that, we add a sense of frustration. How could I let this happen again? Very often, as I was indicating, we get our buttons pushed by, there's an old saying, we get our buttons pushed the most by those who installed them. It should be our families. So sometimes we can feel a sense of shame. How could I behave that way or say that to my sister, father, mother, brother, aunt, my girlfriend, boyfriend, my boss? How could I let that happen? In order to use the tools to lessen and relieve this tendency, which I'll discuss, we first, though, have to talk about what triggers getting our buttons pushed, why it happens, what keeps these tendencies in place. And then once we understand that, it's very easy to develop the tools that help alleviate. So the first thing, it's important to understand that the trigger of getting our buttons pushed is a part of the brain. It's about the size of a walnut, or almond actually, even smaller than walnut. It's almond size. It's the amygdala, which is buried deep in the middle brain and what we used to be called the limbic system. The amygdala is the core of the fight, flight, or freeze. It's your survival mechanism. It's not unique to human beings, cats, dogs, mice. They all have them, rats. They all have amygdalas. And the amygdala works from the moment you're born. It predates most of the other sections of the brain. It's there to keep you alive at all costs. It has its own memory system. And the way it memorizes things is by association, not by narrative or story. It simply equates this is bad. So what happens is whenever you're in a bad or scary situation, your amygdala flares up, records every perception, and notes them all as bad. For example, when I was a kid, I was my parents went to a friend's house with a swimming pool. I was a city kid. I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. I went in the deep end and started flailing about, calling for help. And my parents, I remember seeing them, they had their backs turned and were interacting with the parents, and some older woman or girl, I think it was a girl, probably not even a teenager, just lifted me out of the pool, and I ran yelling to my parents that I almost died. Of course, you know, I was overdramatic. My parents, being around other adults, sort of laughed about it and didn't show the kind of emotional mirroring that I wanted. There was nothing wrong, really, with their response. I probably wasn't near death, but the scariness of the situation, I associated my parents not doing anything and then subsequently not even mirroring my distraught with them being abandoning, not showing up. They weren't really those kind of parents. I mean, but I came away with that association, and I came away with the association that water is bad, the suburbs are bad, you know. Once I was riding on my bike, and naturally somebody, without looking, swung their car door open, and for a few weeks after that, every blue car, I get that limbic reaction. The amygdala is very fast. It actually is much faster than consciousness. Consciousness exists about a half second after all the triggering of the amygdala. So you're actually aware of stuff much later than the amygdala, which gets a quick and dirty picture of everything, scans everything that you're experiencing, and anything you experience reminds you of something that you saw before that was traumatic, or that you associated with trauma, it will release hormones. It will release cortisol, adrenaline. It will trigger the fear response, which is the body tightens, the heartbeat starts rapidly feeding, the breath becomes shallow because we think we're about to be in an argument or about to face death. So the muscles contract, the hair on the back of the neck stands up, and the brain floods with dopamine, which triggers also habitual thoughts in the striatum for survival thoughts. Just get out of here. This person's attacking me. I once was in a car accident and the Ramones were on. The Ramones were not at fault in any way. I was sitting in the passenger seat, a car slammed into the side, and as I saw the car slam in, it was 53rd and 3rd, I think, that was playing. Anyway, from that point on, for a while, when the Ramones would come on, I'd get that reaction. So when we're young and we experience our parents being frightening, not supportive, being aggressive or critical or not mirroring our emotional states, we read their facial expressions. We read their body posture. We read and pick up all sorts of associations, this is bad. And then later on in life, the amygdala still has those associations in place. We might see somebody later on in life mirroring that same facial expression and become very defensive. Or might especially be our parents, even though now they're old and not capable of having any dire effect on our lives as adults. When we're children, our entire life is dependent upon our parents. So any sense of abandonment, any sense of not being taken care of, makes us feel like our very survival is at threat, is at stake. So later on in life, when the same people give us responses that are similar, we have that childhood response. It's deeply ingrained. It's not rational. Sometimes we can simply view a parent's turning away or making a joke as deeply threatening because we feel that they're not taking our needs as children seriously. And then later on, as adults, when they do the same action, we feel threatened. We feel not given any attention. We feel they're not taking us seriously. And even though with other people we could handle such emotions, because it's ingrained so deeply, it sets about the stress response. The body floods with hormones and becomes very stressed. The mind floods with thoughts that are, protect myself, I'm being attacked, I'm being abandoned, I'm being threatened. It's really uncomfortable when one's parents are elderly. I remember getting very frustrated with my dad at one point when he was just, we had put him in an assisted living facility. He was an elderly man, but he was doing something to my sister that triggered something that was decades old. And I remember just this feeling of just wanting to yell at him, which thankfully I breathed, I walked away, and I didn't, but every bone in my body just wanted to shout because it brought up those feelings. Sometimes with repetitive stressful situations, it can be so ingrained, it's very, very difficult to relieve. War veterans who come back from conflict, engagement, when they hear sudden loud backfires of trucks will fall and hit the ground for years and years and years afterwards because the sounds of bombs and the threat is so deeply ingrained in the amygdala that it becomes very, very difficult to detach the associations. So, the point is that when we are triggered in the body, not to become frustrated, because we're getting frustrated with a part of the brain that doesn't understand logic. Feeling that there's something wrong with us, trying to shame ourselves into, I should be better, I should be more appreciative, I should be calmer, I should be more patient. That doesn't work. There are techniques that work, but that's not one of them. Adding more stress to the situation by shaming ourselves only makes it more likely we'll become more defensive. This is not the amygdala is not something, a part of the brain that understands language or reason. It's preconscious. So trying to reason with this part of the brain is an entire waste of time. You're actually arguing with something that was working well beyond your attainment of language or rational thought. It's just a little almond there, thinking this is bad, this is scary, this makes me want to run away. So once we understand that, it begins to change the way we relate to it. Also, it's worth noting that the amygdala is very, very fast, as I said. So not only is it fast, but the hormones stay in place for a while. So even though we might begin to realize we're not at risk, the body will stay stressed out for a good 15 minutes after we've had a stress response, after we've been triggered. So expecting any practice, even a breathing practice, which will work eventually, expecting it to work immediately is futile. It takes a while for the adrenaline to dissipate, no matter what technique we use. Now, on top of these mental ingrained, functions of the amygdala, there's also some habits of thinking that keep us very reactive. The first is victim stories, where we catalog all the times in our life where we've been mistreated, we've been emotionally rejected, we've felt abandoned or avoided or not given our fair shake. We tend to catalog these and recall these studies show much more than we tend to notice and catalog and add to our internal autobiographies the times when people were nice to us, when we've been taken care of, when we were rewarded for things, when we were noticed. The mind is a complaint department. It really, there's a wonderful series of studies that show that we recall with great vivid detail times and words and statements that are hostile. But we almost immediately forget the kind words. So the mind is set up, unless we really practice, to carry around a list of resentments. It takes a lot of effort to rebalance the scales, which is why the Buddha talks so often about reflecting on times that people have been generous and kind to us, because he knew this, that the mind tends to skew or filter our experience towards threats rather than to have an unbiased view. Finally, there's the view that somebody is wrong. Somebody should be acting differently. There's a right and a wrong. I'm right, and you're wrong. Now, this is not to say that people don't act in unskillful ways. People cause harm. People cause suffering. People can act aggressively. There can be people without any boundaries. Every family has one. People can be almost delusional. But thinking that they should be different is where we go astray. We can establish boundaries. We can determine that right now we can't be a part of that person's life, or we can limit our engagement. These are very successful and very important and skillful things to do. We can set time limits for engagement. We can set the circumstances. But insisting and demanding that somebody act different than they are is a complete waste of time. This is not about morality. This is about pragmatism. Nobody will change because you insist that they do so. All that it will do is cause you frustration, and it will make them feel attacked and criticized, and it will make them more likely to act in their habitually ingrained ways. So, rather than arguing with reality by constantly reporting to our friends and to ourselves how this person should be different, instead, it's much more skillful to note this is the way they are. And it's up to me to modify my expectations, my engagement, my what I'm willing to discuss. All these things we can do. With my father, I didn't discuss anything about myself. It was all off the table. Whenever he would ask anything, it would always be about him. I just go, and he was fine with that, to be honest. Most of the time, he couldn't be bothered to ask, but if he did ask, I knew that it was heading in a bad place. So I simply set very firm boundaries, and boundaries are not for them, they're for me. I know, okay, this is not an area I'm willing to talk about. And I'd simply say, no, I'm not going to talk about that. But none of it was based on shooting my parents or my friends or anyone into being different. Now, of course, all of this is a matter of practice. It comes and it very slowly, and it requires, my family was in Buddhist therapy for almost 10 years. It took a lot of work to get to the point where we could exist peacefully with each other. So now I'd like to talk about the tools to relieve ourselves from getting our buttons pushed. The first is, I've got so many, but I'll see which one I want to talk about. All right. It's very important to have a supportive group, a network of people where we can practice when we feel threatened, being honest, not shutting down, not being, on the other hand, attacking, but simply stating how we feel without falling into our tendencies of reacting. When I say reacting is fast, it's habitual, there's only one possible response, and silence that's constructive or appropriate, just reporting how one feels calmly, never seems to be an option. So it's very useful to find a group of a support network to practice this. It rarely works trying to go into the lion's den. You know, if you find yourself triggered by a specific family member or a roommate or a coworker, it rarely works doing this. And a lot of therapeutic practice, they even have people play act, where you play the person and they play you, and you can see different responses. The important thing, though, is that if there's a place or a situation where our buttons are inevitably pushed, it's worthwhile experiencing what it's like to respond in a skillful way with different people, and then bring that muscle memory, that new habit, into play. But expecting ourselves to simply be able to do it out of the blue is often unrealistic. There's a lot of wonderful neuroimaging studies that show that when we label what mood we're in during meditation, for a long period afterwards, the amygdala, our stress response, is much less likely to fire. This is because when we use the right ventromedial part of the brain, it tends to override the amygdala, which simply means if I'm about to talk to you and it's a situation where I feel, or we're talking, and suddenly I begin to feel that tenseness arise, just simply saying to myself, I'm angry. That in and of itself tends to de-trigger the amygdala. Simply noting and labeling what mood we're in, it's a very powerful tool. I found it's much less likely for me to say something I regret when I stop for a moment and I just think, I'm angry. Even more powerful is if I can do three, which is breathing. Very often, when I'm in an engagement or I'm in something that's about to be a confrontation, the first thing that I notice is that the breath becomes very shallow and incomplete. That's a sign of the stress response and full engagement. We never, ever act irresponsibly when we have a deep, calm breath. It just doesn't happen. Trust me. So if I find myself in a situation where I'm feeling overwhelmed, attacked, defensive, when I recall now it's time to take five really deep breaths and make the fucker wait, make them wait, but take those deep breaths, the chances of me saying anything that I regret or doing anything that is unproductive goes down. It's a very important tool because during those deep breaths, I can do something else. I can consider different responses. There's almost always more than one response, but when we're in reactivity, we can only think of one. That's how we know we're reactive as opposed to responding. Responding means there's a choice. I have a choice of how I'm going to respond. I can say something, or I can say nothing. That's the very basis of a response. A reaction means there's no choice. I can only think of one way to behave, one thing to say. So use those deep breaths. Now another important tool is, of course, forgiveness. Forgiveness, when practiced regularly, leads to a transformed relationship. The way in Buddhist practice we forgive is not by agreeing that somebody gets off the hook. Everybody has to live with the results of their misdeeds. I can't, when I forgive you and you forgive me, we're not letting each other off the hook. All we're doing is simply telling or allowing ourselves to not carry around our rich and complicated paths that tend to bring us into each interaction with, I have to be with my parents this weekend. It's going to suck. Or, I have to talk with my roommate about this issue. It's going to suck because it sucked in the past. Or, I have to talk with my boss about this issue. It's going to suck. Generally, the stories we carry around is where we feel we've been hurt. So forgiveness is key. The way we forgive is by first forgiving ourselves, bringing to mind situations and times in our life when we've acted unskillfully, reflecting on the times we've been short with other people or critical, the times where we've run away or not shown up for relationships, the times when we were behaving inappropriately. When we forgive ourselves for these actions, because we deserve to be happy and forgiven, then we bring to mind the people that we have to engage with, and we forgive them. Again, we're simply forgiving them so that we don't have to carry around the narrative of how difficult our relationships have been in the past. We want to open up so that the experience will not be tainted by all the past, so that we can open up to the interaction as it really is, rather than filtered by all of the past experience. This is really important. I once, a job I had a couple of interactions with somebody that was very deeply unpleasant. And I hadn't forgiven her because I felt that it was just a niggling thing. I didn't really think it was going to be that important. But she basically acted in a way that I thought was unnecessary. And when she came into the place I was working, she wasn't doing anything that was unskillful in the slightest. She was being very polite, but I noticed that I was very tense and I was being very short and very unfriendly in my responses. And I came awake in the middle of it, and I was like, well, it wasn't like, I was noticing, okay, I'm having an historical response. This woman is not doing anything inappropriate right now, but I am reacting as if I'm in these previous conversations. So at that point, I did a forgiveness practice, and from that point on, the interactions with her were quite pleasant, simply because I allowed myself to drop the carrying around the story of this woman is a pain in the ass. And when I was carrying around that story, I would filter everything she did as if, oh, this is a pain in the ass speaking, doing pain in the ass things. So it's very important to get to that place. Another tool that I was introduced to by Tara Brach, she spoke out. I was at a workshop with Tara Brach, who's a wonderful Buddhist teacher, and this was years ago, and she talked about when we're being, when we have a history of being triggered by somebody, before you interact with them, close your eyes, visualize a very peaceful place, and then imagine somebody who we respect for their integrity, their calmness, their wisdom. Imagine them appearing. And then ask them how they would interact, how they would stay constructive. Tell them what our goal is for the interaction. And then, as much as we can, bring that wisdom, that person, in with us to the interaction. And before we respond to each statement, see if we can imagine how that person, even let the person speak through us. I've tried it. It's hard. But it sounds like a pretty good idea. In general, it's really important, if there's anything I would have us walk away with tonight. There's also a lot of studies, by the way, that show that simply having a meditation practice that's regular results in an amygdala that fires a lot less randomly. But I would like to say that the most key thing is when we are triggered, notice the way our body and our breath feels. Notice what's going on. Bring the awareness to these areas and relax them. Breathe deeply. The more that we breathe deeply, the more we trigger the vagus nerve, which releases serotonin, which stops the stress response. Breathing deeply, relaxing the body, forgiveness, practicing with friends, making sure our intentions are skillful. These are the keys to working with getting our buttons pushed. Nothing about feeling bad or feeling that there's something wrong about ourselves will work because everybody gets their buttons pushed. It's universal. It's the human condition. So rather than trying to shoot yourself into behaving differently, I encourage you instead to take a gentler, kinder approach to practice tools that actually will work. I thank you for listening. I hope you got something from tonight. And now I need a brave volunteer to ask a question, which then breaks the ice and encourages other people to share, ask questions. Somebody brave who wants good karma. Hi.
Hi. Thanks, Jeff. So,